One was left with a great void on his hands. One was deserted, and not only deserted, but betrayed, inhumanly betrayed. One had no desire to detain her, nor to call her back. One was left with a curse on his lips, with a black hatred which darkened the whole day. Later, moving about the city, moving slowly in pedestrian fashion, crawling like the worm, one gathered rumors of her spectacular flight. She had been seen rounding a certain point. She had dipped here or there, for what reason no one knew. She had done a tailspin elsewhere. She had passed like a comet. She had written letters of smoke in the sky, and so on and so forth. Everything she had done was enigmatic and exasperating, done apparently without purpose. It was like a symbolic and ironic commentary on human life, on the behavior of the ant-like creature man, viewed from another dimension. Between the time she took off and the time she returned, I lived the life of a full-blooded schizzerino. It was not an eternity which elapsed, because somehow eternity has to do with peace and with victory. It is something man-made, something earned. No, I experienced an entr'acte in which every hair turns white to the roots, in which every millimeter of skin itches and burns until the whole body becomes a running sore. I see myself sitting before a table in the dark, my hands and feet growing enormous, as though elephantiasis were overtaking me at a gallop. I hear the blood rushing up to the brain and pounding at the eardrums like Himalayan devils with sledgehammers. I hear her flapping her huge wings, even in Irkutsk, and I know she is pushing on and on, ever further away, ever further beyond reach. It is so quiet in the room, and so frightfully empty, that I shriek and howl just to make a little noise, a little human sound. I try to lift myself from the table, but my feet are too heavy, and my hands have become like the shapeless feet of the rhinoceros. The heavier my body becomes, the lighter the atmosphere of the room. I am going to spread and spread until I fill the room with one solid mass of stiff jelly. I shall fill up even the cracks in the wall. I shall grow through the wall like a parasitic plant, spreading and spreading until the whole house is an indescribable mass of flesh and hair and nails. I know that this is death, but I am powerless to kill the knowledge of it, or the knower. Some tiny particle of me is alive, some speck of consciousness persists, and as the inert carcass expands, this flicker of life becomes sharper and sharper and gleams inside me like the cold fire of a gem. It lights up the whole gluey mass of pulp so that I am like a diver with a torch in the body of a dead marine monster. By some slender, hidden filament, I am still connected with the life above the surface of the deep, but it is so far away, the upper world, and the weight of the corpse so great, that even if it were possible, it would take years to reach the surface. I move around in my own dead body, exploring every nook and cranny of its huge, shapeless mass. It is an endless exploration, for with the ceaseless growth, the whole topography changes, slipping and drifting like the hot magma of the earth. Never for a minute is there terra firma. Never for a minute does anything remain still and recognizable. It is a growth without landmarks, a voyage in which the destination changes with every least move or shudder. It is this interminable filling of space which kills all sense of space or time. The more the body expands, the tinier becomes the world, until at last I feel that everything is concentrated on the head of a pin. Despite the floundering of this enormous dead mass which I have become, I feel that what sustains it, the world out of which it grows, is no bigger than a pinhead. In the midst of pollution, in the very heart and gizzard of death, as it were, I sense the seed, the miraculous, infinitesimal lever which balances the world. I have overspread the world like a syrup, and the emptiness of it is terrifying, but there is no dislodging the seed. The seed has become a little knot of cold fire, which roars like a sun in the vast hollow of the dead carcass. When the great plunder bird returns, exhausted from her flight, she will find me here, in the midst of my nothingness, I, the imperishable schizzerino, a blazing seed hidden in the heart of death. Every day she thinks to find another means of sustenance, but there is no other. Only this eternal seed of light, which by dying each day I rediscover for her. Fly, O devouring bird, fly to the limits of the universe. Here is your nourishment, glowing in the sickening emptiness you have created. You will come back to perish once more in the black hole. You will come back again and again, for you have not the wings to carry you out of the world. This is the only world you can inhabit, this tomb of the snake, where darkness reigns. And suddenly, for no reason at all, when I think of her returning to the nest, I remember Sunday mornings in the little old house near the cemetery. I remember sitting at the piano in my nightshirt, working away at the pedals with bare feet, and the folks lying in bed, toasting themselves in the next room. The rooms opened one on the other, telescope fashion, as in the good old American railroad flats. Sunday mornings, one lay in bed until one was ready to screech with well-being. Toward 11 or so, the folks used to rap on the wall of my room for me to come and play for them. I would dance into the room like the Fratellini brothers, so full of flame and feathers that I could hoist myself like a derrick to the topmost limb of the tree of heaven. I could do anything and everything single-handed, being double-jointed at the same time. The old man called me Sonny Jim because I was full of force, full of vim and vigor. First I would do a few handsprings for them, on the carpet before the bed. Then I would sing falsetto, trying to imitate a ventriloquist's dummy. Then I would dance a few light fantastic steps to show which way the wind lay, and zoom, like a breeze I was on the piano stool and doing a velocity exercise. I always began with Czerny, in order to limber up for the performance. The old man hated Czerny, and so did I, but Czerny was the plot du jour on the bill of fare then, and so Czerny it was until my joints were rubber. In some vague way, Czerny reminds me of the great emptiness which came upon me later. What a velocity I would work up, riveted to the piano stool. It was like swallowing a bottle of tonic at one gulp, and then having someone strap you to the bed. After I had played about 98 exercises, I was ready to do a little improvising. I used to take a fistful of chords and crash the piano from one end to the other, then sullenly modulate into the Burning of Rome or the Ben-Hur chariot race, which everybody liked because it was intelligible noise. Long before I read Wittgenstein's Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, I was composing the music to it in the key of sassafras. I was learned then in science and philosophy, in the history of religions, in inductive and deductive logic, in livermantic, in the shape and weight of skulls, in pharmacopoeia and metallurgy, in all the useless branches of learning which give you indigestion and melancholia before your time. This vomit of learned truck was stewing in my guts the whole week long, waiting for it to come Sunday to be set to music. In between the midnight fire alarm and March Militaire, I would get my inspiration, which was to destroy all the existent forms of harmony, and create my own cacophony. Imagine Uranus well aspected to Mars, to Mercury, to the Moon, to Jupiter, to Venus. It's hard to imagine because Uranus functions best when it is badly aspected, when it is afflicted, so to speak. Yet that music which I gave off Sunday mornings, a music of well-being and of well-nourished desperation, was born of an illogically well-aspected Uranus, firmly anchored in the seventh house. I didn't know it then. I didn't know that Uranus existed, and lucky it was that I was ignorant. But I can see it now, because it was a fluky joy, a phony well-being, a destructive sort of fiery creation. The greater my euphoria, the more tranquil the folks became. Even my sister, who was dippy, became calm and composed. The neighbors used to stand outside the window and listen, and now and then I would hear a burst of applause, and then bang, zip, like a rocket, I was off again, velocity exercise number 947.5. If I happened to espy a cockroach crawling up the wall, I was in bliss. That would lead me without the slightest modulation to opus isit, of my sadly corrugated clavichord. One Sunday, just like that, I composed one of the loveliest scherzos imaginable, to a louse. It was spring, and we were all getting the sulfur treatment. I had been poring all week over Dante's Inferno in English. Sunday came like a thaw, the birds driven so crazy by the sudden heat that they flew in and out of the window, immune to the music. One of the German relatives had just arrived from Hamburg, or Bremen, a maiden aunt who looked like a bulldiker. Just to be near her was sufficient to throw me into a fit of rage. She used to pat me on the head and tell me I would be another Mozart. I hated Mozart, and I hate him still, and so to get even with her, I would play badly, play all the sour notes I knew. And then came the little louse, as I was saying, a real louse which had gotten buried in my winter underwear. I got him out, and I put him tenderly on the tip of a black key. Then I began to do a little gigue around him with my right hand. The noise had probably deafened him. He was hypnotized, it seemed, by my nimble pyrotechnic. This trance-like immobility finally got on my nerves. I decided to introduce a chromatic scale, coming down on him full force with my third finger. I caught him fair and square, but with such force that he was glued to my fingertip. That put the St. Vitus dance in me. From then on the scherzo commenced. It was a potpourri of forgotten melodies, spiced with aloes and the juice of porcupines, played sometimes in three keys at once, and pivoting always like a waltzing mouse around the Immaculate Conception. Later, when I went to hear Prokofiev, I understood what was happening to him. I understood Whitehead and Russell and Jeans and Eddington and Rudolf Eucken and Frobenius and Link Gillespie. I understood why, if there had never been a binomial theorem, man would have invented it. I understood why electricity and compressed air, to say nothing of sprudel baths and fango packs. I understood very clearly, I must say, that man has a dead louse in his blood, and that when you're handed a symphony, or a fresco, or a high explosive, you're really getting an ipecac reaction which was not included in the predestined bill of fare. I understood, too, why I had failed to become the musician I was. All the compositions I had created in my head, all these private and artistic auditions which were permitted me, thanks to St. Hildegard or St. Bridget or John of the Cross or God knows whom, were written for an age to come, an age with less instruments and stronger antennae, stronger eardrums, too. A different kind of suffering has to be experienced before such music can be appreciated. Beethoven staked out the new territory. One is aware of its presence when he erupts, when he breaks down in the very core of his stillness. It is a realm of new vibrations, to us only a misty nebula, for we have yet to pass beyond our own conception of suffering. We have yet to ingest this nebulous world, its travail, its orientation. I was permitted to hear an incredible music lying prone and indifferent to the sorrow about me. I heard the gestation of the new world, the sound of torrential rivers taking their course, the sound of stars grinding and chafing, of fountains clotted with blazing gems. All music is still governed by the old astronomy, is the product of the hothouse, a panacea for Weltschmerz. Music is still the antidote for the nameless, but this is not yet music. Music is planetary fire, an irreducible which is all sufficient. It is the slate-writing of the gods, the abracadabra which the learned and the ignorant alike muff, because the axle has been unhooked. Look to the bowels, to the unconsolable and ineluctable. Nothing is determined, nothing is settled or solved. All this that is going on, all music, all architecture, all law, all government, all invention, all discovery, all this is velocity exercises in the dark. Czerny with a capital Z, riding a crazy white horse in a bottle of mucilage. One of the reasons why I never got anywhere with the bloody music is that it was always mixed up with sex. As soon as I was able to play a song, the cunts were around me like flies. To begin with, it was largely Lola's fault. Lola was my first piano teacher. Lola Neeson. It was a ridiculous name, and typical of the neighborhood we were living in then. It sounded like a stinking bloater or a wormy cunt. To tell the truth, Lola was not exactly a beauty. She looked somewhat like a Kalmuck or a Chinook, with sallow complexion and bilious-looking eyes. She had a few warts and wens, not to speak of the mustache. What excited me, however, was her hairiness. She had wonderful long, fine black hair, which she arranged in ascending and descending buns on her Mongolian skull. At the nape of the neck, she curled it up in a serpentine knot. She was always late in coming, being a conscientious idiot, and by the time she arrived, I was always a bit enervated from masturbating. As soon as she took the stool beside me, however, I became excited again, what with the stinking perfume she soused her armpits with. In the summer she wore loose sleeves, and I could see the tufts of hair under her arms. The sight of it drove me wild. I imagined her as having hair all over, even in her navel. And what I wanted to do was to roll in it, bury my teeth in it. I could have eaten Lola's hair, as a delicacy, if there had been a bit of flesh attached to it. Anyway, she was hairy, that's what I want to say, and being hairy as a gorilla, she got my mind off the music and onto her cunt. I was so damned eager to see that cunt of hers that finally one day I bribed her little brother to let me have a peep at her while she was in the bath. It was even more wonderful than I had imagined. She had a shag that reached from the navel to the crotch, an enormous thick tuft, a sporran, rich as a hand-woven rug. When she went over it with the powder puff, I thought I would faint. The next time she came for the lesson, I left a couple of buttons open on my fly. She didn't seem to notice anything amiss. The following time, I left my whole fly open. This time, she caught on. She said, "I think you've forgotten something, Henry." I looked at her, red as a beet, and I asked her blandly, "What?" She pretended to look away while pointing to it with her left hand. Her hand came so close that I couldn't resist grabbing it and pushing it in my fly. She got up quickly, looking pale and frightened. By this time my prick was out of my fly and quivering with delight. I closed in on her, and I reached up under her dress to get at that hand-woven rug I had seen through the keyhole. Suddenly I got a sound box on the ears, and then another, and then she took me by the ear, and leading me to a corner of the room, she turned my face to the wall and said, "Now button up your fly, you silly boy." We went back to the piano in a few moments, back to Czerny and the velocity exercises. I couldn't see a sharp from a flat anymore, but I continued to play, because I was afraid she might tell my mother of the incident. Fortunately, it was not an easy thing to tell one's mother. The incident, embarrassing as it was, marked a decided change in our relations. I thought that the next time she came she would be severe with me, but on the contrary, she seemed to have dolled herself up, to have sprinkled more perfume over herself, and she was even a bit gay, which was unusual for Lola, because she was a morose, withdrawn type. I didn't dare to open my fly again, but I would get an erection and hold it throughout the lesson, which she must have enjoyed, because she was always stealing sidelong glances in that direction. I was only 15 at the time, and she was easily 25 or 28. It was difficult for me to know what to do, unless it was to deliberately knock her down one day, while my mother was out. For a time I actually shadowed her at night, when she went out alone. She had a habit of going out for long walks alone in the evening. I used to dog her steps, hoping she would get to some deserted spot near the cemetery where I might try some rough tactics. I had a feeling sometimes that she knew I was following her and that she enjoyed it. I think she was waiting for me to waylay her. I think that was what she wanted. Anyway, one night I was lying in the grass near the railroad tracks. It was a sweltering summer's night, and people were lying about anywhere and everywhere, like panting dogs. I wasn't thinking of Lola at all. I was just mooning there, too hot to think about anything. Suddenly, I see a woman coming along the narrow cinder path. I'm lying sprawled out on the embankment, and nobody around that I can notice. The woman is coming along slowly, head down, as though she were dreaming. As she gets close, I recognize her. "Lola," I call. "Lola!" She seems to be really astonished to see me there. "Why, what are you doing here?" she says. And with that, she sits down beside me on the embankment. I didn't bother to answer her. I didn't say a word. I just crawled over her and flattened her. "Not here, please," she begged, but I paid no attention. I got my hand between her legs, all tangled up in that thick sporran of hers, and she was sopping wet, like a horse slavering. It was my first fuck, by Jesus, and it had to be that a train would come along and shower hot sparks over us. Lola was terrified. It was her first fuck, too, I guess, and she probably needed it more than I, but when she felt the sparks, she wanted to tear loose. It was like trying to hold down a wild mare. I couldn't keep her down, no matter how I wrestled with her. She got up, shook her clothes down, and adjusted the bun at the nape of her neck. "You must go home," she says. "I'm not going home," I said. And with that, I took her by the arm and started walking. We walked along in dead silence for quite a distance. Neither of us seemed to be noticing where we were going. Finally, we were out on the highway, and up above us were the reservoirs, and near the reservoirs was a pond. Instinctively, I headed toward the pond. We had to pass under some low-hanging trees as we neared the pond. I was helping Lola to stoop down when suddenly she slipped, dragging me with her. She made no effort to get up. Instead, she caught hold of me and pressed me to her. And to my complete amazement, I also felt her slip her hand in my fly. She caressed me so wonderfully that in a jiffy I came in her hand. Then she took my hand and put it between her legs. She lay back completely relaxed and opened her legs wide. I bent over and kissed every hair on her cunt. I put my tongue in her navel and licked it clean. Then I lay with my head between her legs and lapped up the drool that was pouring from her. She was moaning now and clutching wildly with her hands. Her hair had come completely undone and was lying over her bare abdomen. To make it short, I got it in again, and I held it a long time, for which she must have been damned grateful, because she came I don't know how many times. It was like a pack of firecrackers going off, and with it all she sunk her teeth into me, bruised my lips, clawed me, ripped my shirt, and what the hell not. I was branded like a steer when I got home, and took a look at myself in the mirror. It was wonderful while it lasted, but it didn't last long. A month later the Neesons moved to another city, and I never saw Lola again. But I hung her sporran over the bed, and I prayed to it every night. And whenever I began the Czerny stuff, I would get an erection, thinking of Lola lying in the grass, thinking of her long black hair, the bun at the nape of her neck, the groans she vented, and the juice that poured out of her. Playing the piano was just one long, vicarious fuck for me. I had to wait another 2 years before I would get my end in again, as they say, and then it wasn't so good, because I got a beautiful dose with it. And besides, it wasn't in the grass, and it wasn't summer, and there was no heat in it, but just a cold, mechanical fuck for a buck in a dirty little hotel room, the bastard trying to pretend she was coming, and not coming any more than Christmas was coming. And maybe it wasn't her that gave me the clap, but her pal in the next room, who was laying up with my friend Simmons. It was like this. I had finished so quick with my mechanical fuck that I thought I'd go in and see how it was going with my friend Simmons. Lo and behold, they were still at it, and they were going strong. She was a Czech, his girl, and a bit sappy. She hadn't been at it very long, apparently, and she used to forget herself and enjoy the act. Watching her hand it out, I decided to wait and have a go at her myself. And so I did. And before the week was out, I had a discharge. And after that, I figured it would be blue balls or rocks in the groin. Another year or so, and I was giving lessons myself. And as luck would have it, the mother of the girl I'm teaching is a slut, a tramp, and a trollop, if ever there was one. She was living with a nigger, as I later found out. Seems she couldn't get a prick big enough to satisfy her. Anyway, every time I started to go home, she holed me up at the door and rub it up against me. I was afraid of starting in with her because rumor had it that she was full of sif. But what the hell are you going to do when a hot bitch like that plasters her cunt up against you and slips her tongue halfway down your throat? I used to fuck her standing up in the vestibule, which wasn't so difficult because she was light, and I could hold her in my hands like a doll. And like that I'm holding her one night, when suddenly I hear a key being fitted into the lock, and she hears it too, and she's frightened stiff. There's nowhere to go. Fortunately, there's a portiere hanging at the doorway, and I hide behind that. Then I hear her black buck kissing her and saying, "How are you, honey?" And she saying how she has been waiting up for him and better come right upstairs because she can't wait, and so on. And when the stairs stop squeaking, I gently open the door and sally out, and then by God I have a real fright, because if that black buck ever finds out, I'll have my throat slit, and no mistake about it. And so I stop giving lessons at that joint, but soon the daughter is after me, just turning 16, and won't I come and give her lessons at a friend's house? We begin the Czerny exercises all over again, sparks and everything. It's the first smell of fresh cunt I've had, and it's wonderful, like new-mown hay. We fuck our way through one lesson after another, and in between lessons we do a little extra fucking. And then one day it's the sad story, she's knocked up, and what to do about it. I have to get a Jew boy to help me out, and he wants 25 bucks for the job, and I've never seen 25 bucks in my life. Besides, she's underage. Besides, she might have blood poisoning. I give him $5 on account and beat it to the Adirondacks for a couple of weeks. In the Adirondacks, I meet a schoolteacher who's dying to take lessons. More velocity exercises, more condoms and conundrums. Every time I touch the piano, I seem to shake a cunt loose. If there was a party, I had to bring the fucking music roll along. To me, it was just like wrapping my penis in a handkerchief and slinging it under my arm. In vacation time, at a farmhouse or an inn, where there was always a surplus of cunt, the music had an extraordinary effect. Vacation time was a period I looked forward to the whole year, not because of the cunt so much as because it meant no work. Once out of harness, I became a clown. I was so chock-full of energy that I wanted to jump out of my skin. I remember one summer in the Catskills meeting a girl named Francie. She was beautiful and lascivious, with strong Scotch teats and a row of white, even teeth that was dazzling. It began in the river where we were swimming. We were holding on to the boat, and one of her boobies had slipped out of bounds. I slipped the other one out for her, and then I undid the shoulder straps. She ducked under the boat coyly, and I followed, and as she was coming up for air, I wiggled the bloody bathing suit off her, and there she was, floating like a mermaid, with her big, strong teats bobbing up and down like bloated corks. I wriggled out of my tights, and we began playing like dolphins under the side of the boat. In a little while, her girlfriend came along in a canoe. She was a rather hefty girl, a sort of strawberry blonde with agate-colored eyes and full of freckles. She was rather shocked to find us in the raw, but we soon tumbled her out of the canoe and stripped her. And then the three of us began to play tag under the water, but it was hard to get anywhere with them because they were slippery as eels. After we had had enough of it, we ran to a little bathhouse, which was standing in the field like an abandoned sentry box. We had brought our clothes along, and we were going to get dressed, the three of us, in this little box. It was frightfully hot and sultry, and the clouds were gathering for a storm. Agnes, that was Francie's friend, was in a hurry to get dressed. She was beginning to be ashamed of herself standing there naked in front of us. Francie, on the other hand, seemed to be perfectly at ease. She was sitting on the bench with her legs crossed and smoking a cigarette. Anyway, just as Agnes was pulling on her chemise, there came a flash of lightning and a terrifying clap of thunder right on the heels of it. Agnes screamed and dropped her chemise. There came another flash in a few seconds, and again a peal of thunder, dangerously close. The air got blue all around us, and the flies began to bite, and we felt nervous and itchy and a bit panicky, too. Especially Agnes, who was afraid of the lightning, and even more afraid of being found dead and the three of us, stark naked. She wanted to get her things on and run for the house, she said. And just as she got that off her chest, the rain came down, in buckets full. We thought it would stop in a few minutes, and so we stood there naked, looking out at the steaming river through the partly open door. It seemed to be raining rocks, and the lightning kept playing around us incessantly. We were all thoroughly frightened now, and in a quandary as to what to do. Agnes was wringing her hands and praying out loud. She looked like a George Gross idiot, one of those lopsided bitches with a rosary around the neck and yellow jaundice to boot. I thought she was going to faint on us, or something. Suddenly I got the bright idea of doing a war dance in the rain, to distract them. Just as I jump out to commence my shindig, a streak of lightning flashes and splits open a tree, not far off. I'm so damn scared that I lose my wits. Always when I'm frightened, I laugh. So I laughed, a wild, blood-curdling laugh which made the girls scream. When I heard them scream, I don't know why, but I thought of the velocity exercises, and with that I felt that I was standing in the void, and it was blue all around, and the rain was beating a hot and cold tattoo on my tender flesh. All my sensations had gathered on the surface of the skin, and underneath the outermost layer of skin I was empty, light as a feather, lighter than air, or smoke, or talcum, or magnesium, or any goddamn thing you want. Suddenly I was a Chippewa, and it was the key of sassafras again, and I didn't give a fuck whether the girls were screaming, or fainting, or shitting in their pants, which they were minus anyway. Looking at Crazy Agnes with the rosary around her neck, and her big breadbasket blue with fright, I got the notion to do a sacrilegious dance, with one hand cupping my balls and the other hand thumbing my nose at the thunder and lightning. The rain was hot and cold, and the grass seemed full of dragonflies. I hopped about like a kangaroo, and I yelled at the top of my lungs, "Oh, Father, you wormy old son of a bitch, pull in that fucking lightning or Agnes won't believe in you anymore. Do you hear me, you old prick up there? Stop the shenanigans, you're driving Agnes nutty. Hey, you, are you deaf, you old futzer?" And with a continuous rattle of this defiant nonsense on my lips, I danced around the bathhouse, leaping and bounding like a gazelle, and using the most frightful oaths I could summon. When the lightning cracked, I jumped higher, and when the thunder clapped, I roared like a lion, and then I did a handspring, and then I rolled in the grass like a cub, and I chewed the grass and spit it out for them, and I pounded my chest like a gorilla, and all the time I could see the Czerny exercises, resting on the piano, the white page full of sharps and flats, and the fucking idiot, think I to myself, imagining that that's the way to learn how to manipulate the well-tempered clavichord. And suddenly I thought that Czerny might be in heaven by now, and looking down on me, and so I spat up at him high as I could spit, and when the thunder rolled again, I yelled with all my might, "You bastard, Czerny! You up there! May the lightning twist your balls off! May you swallow your own crooked tail and strangle yourself! Do you hear me, you crazy prick?" But in spite of all my good efforts, Agnes was getting more delirious. She was a dumb Irish Catholic, and she had never heard God spoken to that way before. Suddenly, while I was dancing about in the rear of the bathhouse, she bolted for the river. I heard Francie scream, "Bring her back! She'll drown herself! Bring her back!" I started after her, the rain still coming down like pitchforks, and yelling to her to come back, but she ran on blindly, as though possessed of the devil, and when she got to the water's edge, she dove straight in and made for the boat. I swam after her, and as we got to the side of the boat, which I was afraid she would capsize, I got hold of her round the waist with my one hand, and I started to talk to her, calmly and soothingly, as though I was talking to a child. "Go away from me," she said. "You're an atheist!" Jesus, you could have knocked me over with a feather. So astonished I was to hear that. So that was it. All that hysteria because I was insulting the Lord Almighty? I felt like batting her one in the eye, to bring her to her senses. But we were out over our heads, and I had a fear that she would do some mad thing like pulling the boat over our heads if I didn't handle her right. So I pretended that I was terribly sorry, and I said I didn't mean a word of it, that I had been scared to death, and so on and so forth, and as I talked to her gently, soothingly, I slipped my hand down from her waist, and I gently stroked her ass. That was what she wanted, all right. She was talking to me blubberingly about what a good Catholic she was, and how she had tried not to sin, and maybe she was so wrapped up in what she was saying she didn't know what I was doing, but just the same, when I got my hand in her crotch and said all the beautiful things I could think of, about God, about love, about going to church and confessing and all that crap, she must have felt something, because I had a good 3 fingers inside her and working them around like drunken bobbins. "Put your arms around me, Agnes," I said softly, slipping my hand out and pulling her to me so that I could get my legs between hers. "There, that's a girl. Take it easy now. It'll stop soon." And still talking about the church, the confessional, God, love, and the whole bloody mess, I managed to get it inside of her. "You're very good to me," she said, just as though she didn't know my prick was in her. "And I'm sorry I acted like a fool." "I know, Agnes," I said. "It's all right. Listen, grab me tighter. Yeah, that's it." "I'm afraid the boat's going to tip over," she says, trying her best to keep her ass in position by paddling with her right hand. "Yes, let's get back to the shore," I said, and I start to pull away from her. "Oh, don't leave me," she says, clutching me tighter. "Don't leave me. I'll drown." Just then Francie comes running down to the water. "Hurry," says Agnes. "Hurry, I'll drown." Francie was a good sort, I must say. She certainly wasn't a Catholic, and if she had any morals, they were of the reptilian order. She was one of those girls who were born to fuck. She had no aims, no great desires, showed no jealousy, held no grievances, was constantly cheerful, and not at all unintelligent. At nights when we were sitting on the porch in the dark, talking to the guests, she would come over and sit on my lap with nothing on underneath her dress, and I would slip it into her as she laughed and talked to the others. I think she would have brazened it out before the Pope if she had been given a chance. Back in the city, when I called on her at her home, she pulled the same stunt off in front of her mother, whose sight, fortunately, was growing dim. If we went dancing, and she got too hot in the pants, she would drag me to a telephone booth, and queer girl that she was, she'd actually talk to someone, someone like Agnes, for example, while pulling off the trick. She seemed to get a special pleasure out of doing it under people's noses. She said there was more fun in it if you didn't think about it too hard. In the crowded subway, coming home from the beach, say, she'd slip her dress around so that the slit was in the middle and take my hand and put it right on her cunt. If the train was tightly packed and we were safely wedged in a corner, she'd take my cock out of my fly and hold it in her two hands, as though it were a bird. Sometimes she'd get playful and hang her bag on it, as though to prove that there wasn't the least danger. Another thing about her was that she didn't pretend that I was the only guy she had on the string. Whether she told me everything, I don't know, but she certainly told me plenty. She told me about her affairs, laughingly, while she was climbing over me, or when I had it in her, or just when I was about to come. She would tell me how they went about it, how big they were, or how small, what they said when they got excited, and so on and so forth, giving me every possible detail, just as though I were going to write a textbook on the subject. She didn't seem to have the least feeling of sacredness about her own body, or her feelings, or anything connected with herself. "Francie, you bloody fucker," I used to say. "You've got the morals of a clam." "But you like me, don't you?" she'd answer. "Men like to fuck, and so do women. It doesn't harm anybody, and it doesn't mean you have to love everyone you fuck, does it?" "I wouldn't want to be in love. It must be terrible to have to fuck the same man all the time, don't you think? Listen, if you didn't fuck anybody but me all the time, you'd get tired of me quick, wouldn't you? Sometimes it's nice to be fucked by someone you don't know at all." "Yes, I think that's the best of all," she added. "There's no complications, no telephone numbers, no love letters, no scraps, what? Listen, do you think this is very bad? Once I tried to get my brother to fuck me. You know what a sissy he is. He gives everybody a pain. I don't remember exactly how it was anymore, but anyway, we were in the house alone, and I was passionate that day. He came into my bedroom to ask me for something. I was lying there with my dress up, thinking about it and wanting it terribly. And when he came in, I didn't give a damn about his being my brother. I just thought of him as a man. And so I lay there with my skirt up, and I told him I wasn't feeling well, that I had a pain in my stomach. He wanted to run right out and get something for me, but I told him no, just to rub my stomach a bit. That would do it good. I opened my waist and made him rub my bare skin. He was trying to keep his eyes on the wall, the big idiot, and rubbing me as though I were a piece of wood. "It's not there, you chump," I said. "It's lower down. What are you afraid of?" And I pretended that I was in agony. Finally, he touched me accidentally. "There! That's it!" I shouted. "Oh, do rub it. It feels so good." Do you know the big sap actually massaged me for 5 minutes without realizing that it was all a game? I was so exasperated that I told him to get the hell out and leave me alone. "You're a eunuch," I said, but he was such a sap I don't think he knew what the word meant. She laughed, thinking what a ninny her brother was. She said he probably still had his maiden. What did I think about it? Was it so terribly bad? Of course, she knew I wouldn't think anything of the kind. "Listen, Francie," I said, "did you ever tell that story to the cop you're going with?" She guessed she hadn't. "I guess so, too," I said. "He'd beat the piss out of you if he ever heard that yarn." "He socked me already," she answered promptly. "What?" I said. "You let him beat you up?" "I don't ask him to," she said, "but you know how quick-tempered he is. I don't let anybody else sock me, but somehow coming from him, I don't mind it so much. Sometimes it makes me feel good inside. I don't know. Maybe a woman ought to get beaten up once in a while. It doesn't hurt so much if you really like a guy, and afterwards he's so damn gentle. I almost feel ashamed of myself." It isn't often you get a cunt who'll admit such things. I mean a regular cunt and not a moron. There was Trix Miranda, for example, and her sister, Mrs. Costello. A fine pair of birds they were. Trix, who was going with my friend McGregor, tried to pretend to her own sister, with whom she was living, that she had no sexual relations with McGregor. And the sister was pretending to all and sundry that she was frigid, that she couldn't have any relations with a man, even if she wanted to, because she was built too small. And meanwhile, my friend McGregor was fucking them silly, both of them, and they both knew about each other, but still they lied like that to each other. Why? I couldn't make it out. The Costello bitch was hysterical. Whenever she felt that she wasn't getting a fair percentage of the lays that McGregor was handing out, she'd throw a pseudo-epileptic fit. That meant throwing towels over her, patting her wrists, opening her bosom, chafing her legs, and finally hoisting her upstairs to bed, where my friend McGregor would look after her as soon as he had put the other one to sleep. Sometimes the two sisters would lie down together to take a nap on an afternoon, If MacGregor were around, he would go upstairs and lie between them. As he explained it to me laughingly, the trick was for him to pretend to go to sleep. He would lie there, breathing heavily, opening now one eye, now the other, to see which one was really dozing off. As soon as he was convinced that one of them was asleep, he'd tackle the other. On such occasions he seemed to prefer the hysterical sister, Mrs. Costello, whose husband visited her about once every 6 months. The more risk he ran, the more thrill he got out of it, he said. If it were with the other sister, Trix, whom he was supposed to be courting, he had to pretend that it would be terrible if the other one were to catch them like that, and at the same time he admitted to me he was always hoping that the other one would wake up and catch them. But the married sister, the one who was built too small, as she used to say, was a wily bitch, and besides she felt guilty toward her sister, and if her sister had ever caught her in the act, she'd probably have pretended that she was having a fit and didn't know what she was doing. Nothing on earth could make her admit that she was actually permitting herself the pleasure of being fucked by a man. I knew her quite well, because I was giving her lessons for a time, and I used to do my damnedest to make her admit that she had a normal cunt and that she'd enjoy a good fuck if she could get it now and then. I used to tell her wild stories, which were really thinly disguised accounts of her own doings, and yet she remained adamant. I had even gotten her to the point one day, and this beats everything, where she let me put my finger inside her. I thought sure it was settled. It's true she was dry and a bit tight, but I put that down to her hysteria. But imagine getting that far with a cunt, and then having her say to your face, as she yanks her dress down violently, "You see? I told you I wasn't built right." "I don't see anything of the kind," I said angrily. "What do you expect me to do, use a microscope on you?" "I like that," she said, pretending to get on her high horse. "What a way of talking to me." "You know damned well you're lying," I continued. "Why do you lie like that? Don't you think it's human to have a cunt and to use it once in a while? Do you want it to dry up on you?" "Such language," she said, biting her underlip and reddening like a beet. "I always thought you were a gentleman." "Well, you're no lady," I retorted, "because even a lady admits to a fuck now and then, and besides, ladies don't ask gentlemen to stick their fingers up inside them and see how small they're built."
"I never asked you to touch me," she said. "I wouldn't think of asking you to put your hand on me, on my private parts anyway."
"Maybe you thought I was going to swab your ear for you, is that it?"
"I thought of you like a doctor at that moment. That's all I can say," she said stiffly, trying to freeze me out.
"Listen," I said, taking a wild chance. "Let's pretend that it was all a mistake, that nothing happened, nothing at all. I know you too well to think of insulting you like that. I wouldn't think of doing a thing like that to you. No, damned if I would. I was just wondering if maybe you weren't right in what you said, if maybe you aren't built rather small. You know, it all went so quick I couldn't tell what I felt. I don't think I even put my finger inside you. I must have just touched the outside, that's about all. Listen, sit down here on the couch. Let's be friends again." I pulled her down beside me. She was melting visibly, and I put my arm around her waist as though to console her more tenderly. "Has it always been like that?" I asked innocently, and I almost laughed the next moment, realizing what an idiotic question it was. She hung her head coyly, as though we were touching on an unmentionable tragedy.
"Listen, maybe if you sat on my lap," and I hoisted her gently onto my lap, at the same time delicately putting my hand under her dress and resting it lightly on her knee. "Maybe if you sat a moment like this, you'd feel better. There, that's it. Just snuggle back into my arms. Are you feeling better?" She didn't answer, but she didn't resist either. She just lay back limply and closed her eyes. Gradually, and very gently and smoothly, I moved my hand up her leg, talking to her in a low, soothing voice all the time. When I got my fingers into her crotch and parted the little lips, she was as moist as a dish rag. I massaged it gently, opening it up more and more, and still handing out a telepathic line about women sometimes being mistaken about themselves, and how sometimes they think they're very small when they're really quite normal. And the longer I kept it up, the juicier she got, and the more she opened up. I had four fingers inside her, and there was room inside for more, if I had had more to put in. She had an enormous cunt, and it had been well reamed out, I could feel. I looked at her to see if she was still keeping her eyes shut. Her mouth was open, and she was gasping, but her eyes were tight shut, as though she were pretending to herself that it was all a dream. I could move her about roughly now, no danger of the slightest protest,
and maliciously, perhaps, I jostled her about, unnecessarily, just to see if she would come to. She was as limp as a feather pillow, and even when her head struck the arm of the sofa, she showed no sign of irritation. It was as though she had anesthetized herself for a gratuitous fuck. I pulled all her clothes off and threw them on the floor, and after I had given her a bit of a workout on the sofa, I slipped it out and laid her on the floor on her clothes. And then I slipped it in again, and she held it tight with that suction valve she used so skillfully, despite the outward appearance of coma. It seemed strange to me that the music always passed off into sex. Nights, if I went out alone for a walk, I was sure to pick up someone, a nurse, a girl coming out of a dance hall, a sales girl, anything with a skirt on. If I went out with my friend McGregor in his car, just a little spin to the beach, he would say, I would find myself by midnight sitting in some strange parlor in some queer neighborhood with a girl on my lap, usually one I didn't give a damn about because McGregor was even less selective than I. Often, stepping in his car, I'd say to him, Listen, no cunts tonight, what? And he'd say, Jesus, no, I'm fed up. Just a little drive somewhere. Maybe to Sheepshead Bay, what do you say? We wouldn't have gone more than a mile when suddenly he'd pull the car up to the curb and nudge me. Get a look at that, he'd say, pointing to a girl strolling along the sidewalk. Jesus, what a leg. Or else, Listen, what do you say we ask her to come along? Maybe she can dig up a friend. And before I could say another word, he'd be hailing her and handing out his usual patter, which was the same for everyone. And 9 times out of 10, the girl came along. And before we'd gone very far, feeling her up with his free hand, he'd ask her if she didn't have a friend she could dig up to keep us company. And if she put up a fuss, if she didn't like being pawed over that way too quickly, he'd say, All right, get the hell out then. We can't waste any time on the likes of you. And with that, he'd slow up and shove her out. We can't be bothered with cunts like that, can we, Henry? He'd say, chuckling softly. You wait. I promise you something good before the night's over. And if I reminded him that we were going to lay off for one night, he'd answer, Well, just as you like. I was only thinking it might make it more pleasant for you. And then suddenly the brakes would pull us up, and he'd be saying to some silky silhouette looming out of the dark, Hello, sister. What you doing? Taking a little stroll? And maybe this time it would be something exciting, a dithery little bitch with nothing else to do but pull up her skirt and hand it to you. Maybe we wouldn't even have to buy her a drink, just haul up somewhere on a side road and go at it, one after the other, in the car. And if she was an empty-headed bimbo, as they usually were, he wouldn't even bother to drive her home. We're not going that way, he'd say, the bastard that he was. You'd better jump out here. And with that, he'd open the door and out with her. His next thought was, of course, was she clean? That would occupy his mind all the way back. Jesus, we ought to be more careful, he'd say. You don't know what you're getting yourself into, picking them up like that. Ever since the last one, you remember the one we picked up on the drive? I've been itchy as hell. Maybe it's just nervousness. I think about it too much. Why can't a guy stick to one cunt? Tell me that, Henry. You take tricks now. She's a good kid, you know that. And I like her, too, in a way, but... Shit! What's the use of talking about it? You know me, I'm a glutton. You know, I'm getting so bad that sometimes when I'm on my way to a date, mind you, with a girl I want to fuck, and everything fixed, too, as I say, sometimes I'm rolling along, and maybe out of the corner of my eye I catch a flash of a leg crossing the street, and before I know it I've got her in the car, and the hell with the other girl. I must be cunt-struck, I guess. What do you think? Don't tell me, he would add quickly. I know you, you bugger. You'll be sure to tell me the worst. And then, after a pause, You're a funny guy, do you know that? I never notice you refusing anything, but somehow you don't seem to be worrying about it all the time. Sometimes you strike me as though you didn't give a damn one way or the other. And you're a steady bastard, too, almost a monogamist, I'd say. How you can keep it up so long with one woman beats me. Don't you get bored with them? Jesus, I know so well what they're going to say. Sometimes I feel like saying, you know, just breeze in on them and say, Listen, kid, don't say a word. Just fish it out and open your legs wide. He laughed heartily. Can you imagine the expression on Trix's face if I pulled a line like that on her? I tell you, once I came pretty near doing it, I kept my hat and coat on. Was she sore? She didn't mind my keeping my coat on so much, but the hat?
I told her I was afraid of a draft. Of course, there wasn't any draft. The truth is, I was so damned impatient to get away that I thought if I kept my hat on, I'd be off quicker. Instead, I was there all night with her. She put up such a row that I couldn't get her quiet. But listen, that's nothing. Once I had a drunken Irish bitch, and this one had some queer ideas. In the first place, she never wanted it in bed, always on the table. You know, that's all right once in a while, but if you do it often, it wears you out. So one night, I was a little tight, I guess. I says to her, "No, nothing doing, you drunken bastard. You're going to go to bed with me tonight. I want a real fuck, in bed." You know, I had to argue with that bitch for an hour almost before I could persuade her to go to bed with me, and then only on the agreement that I was to keep my hat on. Listen, can you picture me getting over that stupid bitch with my hat on? And stark naked to boot? I asked her, I said, "Why do you want me to keep my hat on?" You know what she said? She said it seemed more genteel. Can you imagine what a mind that cunt had? I used to hate myself for going with that bitch. I never went to her sober, that's one thing. I'd have to be tanked up first and kind of blind and batty. You know how I get sometimes. I knew very well what he meant. He was one of my oldest friends, and one of the most cantankerous bastards I ever knew. Stubborn wasn't the word for it. He was like a mule, a pig-headed Scotchman. And his old man was even worse. When the two of them got into a rage, it was a pretty sight. The old man used to dance, positively dance, with rage. If the old lady got between, she'd get a sock in the eye. They used to put him out of the house regularly. Out he'd go with all his belongings, including the furniture, including the piano, too. In a month or so, he'd be back again, because they always gave him credit at home. And then he'd come home drunk some night with a woman he'd picked up somewhere, and the rumpus would start all over again. It seems they didn't mind so much his coming home with a girl and keeping her all night, but what they did object to was the cheek of him asking his mother to serve them breakfast in bed. If his mother tried to bawl him out, he'd shut her up by saying, "What are you trying to tell me? You wouldn't have been married yet if you hadn't been knocked up." The old lady would wring her hands and say, "What a son! What a son! God help me, what have I done to deserve this?" To which he'd remark, "Oh, forget it, you're just an old prune." Often as not, his sister would come up to try and smooth matters out. "Jesus, Wally," she'd say, "it's none of my business what you do, but can't you talk to your mother more respectfully?" Whereupon MacGregor would make his sister sit on the bed and start coaxing her to bring up the breakfast. Usually he'd have to ask his bedmate what her name was in order to present her to his sister. "She's not a bad kid," he'd say, referring to his sister. "She's the only decent one in the family. Now listen, sis, bring up some grub, will you? Some nice bacon and eggs, eh? What do you say? Listen, is the old man around? What's his mood today? I'd like to borrow a couple of bucks. You try and worm it out of him, will you? I'll get you something nice for Christmas." Then, as though everything was settled, he'd pull back the covers to expose the wench beside him. "Look at her, sis. Ain't she beautiful? Look at that leg. Listen, you ought to get yourself a man. You're too skinny. Patsy here, I bet she doesn't go begging for it. Eh, Patsy?" And with that, a sound slap on the rump for Patsy. "Now scram, sis. I want some coffee. And don't forget, make the bacon crisp. Don't get any of that lousy store bacon. Get something extra. And be quick about it." What I liked about him were his weaknesses. Like all men who practice willpower, he was absolutely flabby inside. There wasn't a thing he wouldn't do, out of weakness. He was always very busy, and he was never really doing anything. And always boning up on something, always trying to improve his mind. For example, he would take the unabridged dictionary, and tearing out a page each day, would read it through religiously on his way back and forth from the office. He was full of facts, and the more absurd and incongruous the facts, the more pleasure he derived from them. He seemed to be bent on proving to all and sundry that life was a farce, that it wasn't worth the game, that one thing cancelled out another, and so on. He was brought up on the north side, not very far from the neighborhood in which I had spent my childhood. He was very much a product of the north side, too, and that was one of the reasons why I liked him. The way he talked, out of the corner of his mouth, for instance. The tough air he put on when talking to a cop, the way he spat in disgust, the peculiar curse words he used, the sentimentality, the limited horizon, the passion for playing pool or shooting craps, the staying up all night, swapping yarns, the contempt for the rich, the hobnobbing with politicians, the curiosity about worthless things, the respect for learning, the fascination of the dance hall, the saloon, the burlesque, talking about seeing the world and never budging out of the city, idolizing no matter whom, so long as the person showed spunk. A thousand and one little traits, or peculiarities of this sort, endeared him to me, because it was precisely such idiosyncrasies which marked the fellows I had known as a child. The neighborhood was composed of nothing, it seemed, but lovable failures. The grown-ups behaved like children, and the children were incorrigible. Nobody could rise very far above his neighbor, or he'd be lynched. It was amazing that anyone ever became a doctor or a lawyer. Even so, he had to be a good fellow, had to pretend to talk like everyone else, and he had to vote the Democratic ticket. To hear McGregor talk about Plato, or Nietzsche, for instance, to his buddies, was something to remember. In the first place, to even get permission to talk about such things as Plato or Nietzsche to his companions, he had to pretend that it was only by accident that he had run across their names. Or perhaps he'd say that he had met an interesting drunk one night in the back room of a saloon, and this drunk had started talking about these guys, Nietzsche and Plato. He would even pretend he didn't quite know how the names were pronounced. Plato wasn't such a dumb bastard, he would say apologetically. Plato had an idea or two in his bean. Yes, sir. Yes, siree. He'd like to see one of those dumb politicians at Washington trying to lock horns with a guy like Plato. And he'd go on, in this roundabout, matter-of-fact fashion, to explain to his crap-shooting friends just what kind of a bright bird Plato was in his time, and how he measured up against other men in other times. Of course, he was probably a eunuch, he would add, by way of throwing a little cold water on all this erudition. In those days, as he nimbly explained, the big guys, the philosophers, often had their nuts cut off, a fact, so as to be out of all temptation. The other guy, Nietzsche, he was a real case, a case for the bughouse. He was supposed to be in love with his sister, hypersensitive-like, had to live in a special climate, in Nice, he thought it was. As a rule, he didn't care much for the Germans, but this guy Nietzsche was different. As a matter of fact, he hated the Germans, this Nietzsche. He claimed he was a Pole, or something like that. He had them dead right, too. He said they were stupid and swinish, and by God, he knew what he was talking about. Anyway, he showed them up. He said they were full of shit, to make it brief, and by God, wasn't he right, though? Did you see the way those bastards turned tail when they got a dose of their own medicine? Listen, I know a guy who cleaned out a nestful of them in the Argonne region. He said they were so goddamn low he wouldn't shit on them. He said he wouldn't even waste a bullet on them. He just bashed their brains in with a club. I forget this guy's name now, but anyway, he told me he saw plenty in the few months he was there. He said the best fun he got out of the whole fucking business was to pop off his own major. Not that he had any special grievance against him. He just didn't like his mug. He didn't like the way the guy gave orders. Most of the officers that were killed got it in the back, he said. Served them right, too, the pricks. He was just a lad from the north side. I think he runs a pool room now down near Wallabout Market. A quiet fellow, minds his own business. But if you start talking to him about the war, he goes off the handle. He says he'd assassinate the President of the United States if they ever tried to start another war. Yeah, and he'd do it, too, I'm telling you. But shit, what was that I wanted to tell you about Plato? Oh, yeah. When the others were gone, he'd suddenly shift gears. You don't believe in talking like that, do you? He'd begin. I had to admit I didn't. You're wrong, he'd continue. You've got to keep in with people. You don't know when you may need one of these guys. You act on the assumption that you're free, independent. You act as though you were superior to these people. Well, that's where you make a big mistake. How do you know where you'll be 5 years from now, or even 6 months from now? You might be blind. You might be run over by a truck. You might be put in the bughouse. You can't tell what's going to happen to you. Nobody can. You might be as helpless as a baby. So what? I would say. Well, don't you think it would be good to have a friend when you need one? You might be so goddamned helpless you'd be glad to have someone help you across the street. You think these guys are worthless. You think I'm wasting my time with them. Listen, you never know what a man might do for you someday. Nobody gets anywhere alone. He was touchy about my independence, what he called my indifference. If I was obliged to ask him for a little dough, he was delighted. That gave him a chance to deliver a little sermon on friendship. So you have to have money, too, he'd say, with a big, satisfied grin spreading all over his face. So the poet has to eat, too. Well, well. It's lucky you came to me, Henry, me boy, because I'm easy with you. I know you, you heartless son of a bitch. Sure, what do you want? I haven't got very much, but I'll split it with you. That's fair enough, isn't it? Or do you think, you bastard, that maybe I ought to give you it all, and go out and borrow something for myself? I suppose you want a good meal, eh? Ham and eggs wouldn't be good enough, would it? I suppose you'd like me to drive you to the restaurant, too, eh? Listen, get up from that chair a minute. I want to put a cushion under your ass. Well, well, so you're broke. Jesus, you're always broke. I never remember seeing you with money in your pocket. Listen, don't you ever feel ashamed of yourself? You talk about those bums I hang out with? Well, listen, mister, those guys never come and bum me for a dime like you do. They've got more pride. They'd rather steal it than come and grub it off me. But you, shit, you're full of highfalutin ideas. You want to reform the world and all that crap. You don't want to work for money. No, not you. You expect somebody to hand it to you on a silver platter. Huh. Lucky there's guys like me around that understand you. You need to get wise to yourself, Henry. You're dreaming. Everybody wants to eat. Don't you know that? Most people are willing to work for it. They don't lie in bed all day like you and then suddenly pull on their pants and run to the first friend at hand. Supposing I wasn't here, what would you have done? Don't answer. I know what you're going to say. But listen, you can't go on all your life like that. Sure, you talk fine. It's a pleasure to listen to you. You're the only guy I know that I really enjoy talking to, but where's it going to get you? One of these days they'll lock you up for vagrancy. You're just a bum, don't you know that? You're not even as good as those other bums you preach about. Where are you when I'm in a jam? You can't be found. You don't answer my letters. You don't answer the telephone. You even hide sometimes when I come to see you. Listen, I know. You don't have to explain to me. I know you don't want to hear my stories all the time, but shit. Sometimes I really have to talk to you. A fucking lot you care, though. So long as you're out of the rain and putting another meal under your belt, you're happy. You don't think about your friends until you're desperate. That's no way to behave, is it? Say no and I'll give you a buck. God damn it, Henry. You're the only real friend I've got, but you're a son of a bitch of a mucker if I know what I'm talking about. You're just a born good-for-nothing son of a bitch. You'd rather starve than turn your hand to something useful. Naturally, I'd laugh and hold my hand out for the buck he had promised me. That would irritate him afresh. You're ready to say anything, aren't you? If only I'd give you the buck I promised you. What a guy. Talk about morals. Jesus, you've got the ethics of a rattlesnake. No, I'm not giving it to you yet, by Christ. I'm going to torture you a little more first. I'm going to make you earn this money if I can. Listen, what about shining my shoes? Do that for me, will you? They'll never get shined if you don't do it now. I pick up the shoes and ask him for the brush. I don't mind shining his shoes, not in the least. But that, too, seems to incense him. You gonna shine them, are you? Well, by Jesus, that beats all hell. Listen, where's your pride? Didn't you ever have any? And you're the guy that knows everything. It's amazing. You know so goddamn much that you have to shine your friend's shoes to worm a meal out of him. A fine pickle. Here, you bastard, here's the brush. Shine the other pair, too, while you're at it. A pause. He's washing himself at the sink and humming a bit. Suddenly, in a bright, cheerful tone, "How is it today, Henry? Is it sunny? Listen, I've got just the place for you. What do you say to scallops and bacon with a little tartar sauce on the side? It's a little joint down near the inlet. A day like today is just the day for scallops and bacon. Eh, what, Henry? Don't tell me you've got something to do. If I haul you down there, you've got to spend a little time with me. You know that, don't you? Jesus, I wish I had your disposition. You just drift along from minute to minute. Sometimes I think you're a damn sight better off than any of us. Even if you are a stinking son of a bitch, and a traitor, and a thief. When I'm with you, the day seems to pass like a dream. Listen, don't you see what I mean when I say I've got to see you sometimes? I go nuts being all by myself all the time. Why do I go chasing around after cunt so much? Why do I play cards all night? Why do I hang out with those bums from the Point? I need to talk to someone, that's what. A little later at the bay, sitting out over the water, with a shot of rye in him and waiting for the seafood to be served up. Life's not so bad if you can do what you want, hey, Henry? If I make a little dough, I'm going to take a trip around the world, and you're coming along with me. Yes, though you don't deserve it, I'm going to spend some real money on you one day. I want to see how you'd act if I gave you plenty of rope. I'm going to give you the money, see? I won't pretend to lend it to you. We'll see what'll happen to your fine ideas when you have some dough in your pocket. Listen, when I was talking about Plato the other day, I meant to ask you something. I meant to ask you if you ever read that yarn of his about Atlantis. Did you? You did? Well, what do you think of it? Do you think it was just a yarn, or do you think there might have been a place like that once? I didn't dare to tell him that I suspected there were hundreds and thousands of continents whose existence, past or future, we hadn't even begun to dream about. So I simply said I thought it quite possible indeed that such a place as Atlantis might once have been. "Well, it doesn't matter much one way or the other, I suppose," he went on. "But I'll tell you what I think. I think there must have been a time like that once, a time when men were different. I can't believe that they always were the pigs they are now, and have been for the last few thousand years. I think it's just possible that there was a time when men knew how to live, when they knew how to take it easy and to enjoy life. Do you know what drives me crazy? It's looking at my old man. Ever since he's retired, he sits in front of the fire all day long and mopes. To sit there like a broken-down gorilla, that's what he slaved for all his life. Oh, shit. If I thought that was going to happen to me, I'd blow my brains out now. Look around you. Look at the people we know. Do you know one that's worthwhile? What's all the fuss about, I'd like to know. We've got to live, they say. Why? That's what I want to know. They'd all be a damn sight better off dead. They're all just so much manure. When the war broke out, and I saw them go off to the trenches, I said to myself, good. Maybe they'll come back with a little sense. A lot of them didn't come back, of course. But the others? Listen, do you suppose they got more human? More considerate? Not at all. They're all butchers at heart, and when they're up against it, they squeal. They make me sick, the whole fucking lot of them. I see what they're like, bailing them out every day. I see it from both sides of the fence. On the other side, it stinks even worse. Why, if I told you some of the things I knew about the judges who condemn these poor bastards, you'd want to slug them. All you have to do is look at their faces. Yes, sir, Henry, I'd like to think there was once a time when things were different. We haven't seen any real life, and we're not going to see any. This thing is going to last another few thousand years, if I know anything about it. You think I'm mercenary. You think I'm cuckoo to want to earn a lot of money, don't you? Well, I'll tell you, I want to earn a little pile so that I can get my feet out of this muck. I'd go off and live with a nigger wench if I could get away from this atmosphere. I've worked my balls off trying to get where I am, which isn't very far. I don't believe in work any more than you do. I was trained that way, that's all. If I could put over a deal, if I could swindle a pile out of one of these dirty bastards I'm dealing with, I'd do it with a clear conscience. I know a little too much about the law, that's the trouble. But I'll fool them yet, you'll see. And when I put it over, I'll put it over big. Another shot of rye, as the seafood's coming along, and he starts in again. I meant that about taking you on a trip with me. I'm thinking about it seriously. I suppose you'll tell me you've got a wife and a kid to look after. Listen, when are you going to break off with that battle axe of yours? Don't you know that you've got to ditch her? He begins to laugh softly. To think that I was the one who picked her out for you. Did I ever think you'd be chump enough to get hitched up to her? I thought I was recommending you a nice piece of tail, and you, you poor slob, you marry her. Listen to me, Henry, while you've got a little sense left. Don't let that sour bald puss muck up your life for you. Do you get me? I don't care what you do or where you go. I'd hate to see you leave town. I'd miss you, I'm telling you that frankly, but Jesus, if you have to go to Africa, beat it. Get out of her clutches. She's no good for you. Sometimes when I get hold of a good cunt, I think to myself, now there's something nice for Henry, and I have in mind to introduce her to you, and then, of course, I forget, but Jesus, man, there's thousands of cunts in the world you can get along with. To think that you had to pick on a mean bitch like that. Do you want more bacon? You'd better eat what you want now, you know. There won't be any dough later. Have another drink, eh? Listen, if you try to run away from me today, I swear I'll never lend you a cent. What was I saying? Oh, yeah, about that screwy bitch you married. Listen, are you going to do it or not? Every time I see you, you tell me you're going to run away, but you never do it. You don't think you're supporting her, I hope. She don't need you, you sap. Don't you see that? She just wants to torture you. As for the kid, well, shit. If I were in your boots, I'd drown it. That sounds kind of mean, doesn't it? But you know what I mean. You're not a father. I don't know what the hell you are. I just know you're too goddamned good a fellow to be wasting your life on them. Listen, why don't you try to make something of yourself? You're young yet, and you make a good appearance. Go off somewhere, way the hell off, and start all over again. If you need a little money, I'll raise it for you. It's like throwing it down a sewer, I know, but I'll do it for you just the same. The truth is, Henry, I like you a hell of a lot. I've taken more from you than I would from anybody in the world. I guess we have a lot in common, coming from the old neighborhood. Funny I didn't know you in those days. Shit, I'm getting sentimental. The day wore on like that, with lots to eat and drink, the sun out strong, a car to tote us around, cigars in between, dozing a little on the beach, studying the cunts passing by, talking, laughing, singing a bit too. One of many, many days I spent like that with McGregor. Days like that really seemed to make the wheels stop. On the surface it was jolly and happy-go-lucky, time passing like a sticky dream. But underneath it was fatalistic, premonitory, leaving me the next day morbid and restless. I knew very well I'd have to make a break someday. I knew very well I was pissing my time away. But I knew also that there was nothing I could do about it, yet. Something had to happen, something big, something that would sweep me off my feet. All I needed was a push, but it had to be some force outside my world that could give me the right push. That I was certain of. I couldn't eat my heart out because it wasn't in my nature. All my life things had worked out all right, in the end. It wasn't in the cards for me to exert myself. Something had to be left to Providence. In my case, a whole lot. Despite all the outward manifestations of misfortune or mismanagement, I knew that I was born with a silver spoon in my mouth, and with a double crown, too. The external situation was bad, admitted, but what bothered me more was the internal situation. I was really afraid of myself, of my appetite, my curiosity, my flexibility, my permeability, my malleability, my geniality, my powers of adaptation. No situation in itself could frighten me. I somehow always saw myself sitting pretty, sitting inside a buttercup, as it were, and sipping the honey. Even if I were flung in jail, I had a hunch I'd enjoy it. It was because I knew how not to resist, I suppose. Other people wore themselves out, tugging and straining and pulling. My strategy was to float with the tide. What people did to me didn't bother me nearly so much as what they were doing to others, or to themselves. I was really so damned well off inside that I had to take on the problems of the world. And that's why I was in a mess all the time. I wasn't synchronized with my own destiny, so to speak. I was trying to live out the world destiny. If I got home of an evening, for instance, and there was no food in the house, not even for the kid, I would turn right around and go looking for the food. But what I noticed about myself, and that was what puzzled me, was that no sooner outside and hustling for the grub than I was back at the Weltanschauung again. I didn't think of food for us, exclusively. I thought of food in general, food in all its stages, everywhere in the world at that hour, and how it was gotten, and how it was prepared, and what people did if they didn't have it, and how maybe there was a way to fix it so that everybody would have it when they wanted it, and no more time wasted on such an idiotically simple problem. I felt sorry for the wife and kid, sure. But I also felt sorry for the Hottentots and the Australian Bushmen, not to mention the starving Belgians and the Turks and the Armenians. I felt sorry for the human race, for the stupidity of man and his lack of imagination. Missing a meal wasn't so terrible. It was the ghastly emptiness of the street that disturbed me profoundly. All those bloody houses, one like another, and all so empty and cheerless-looking. Fine paving stones underfoot, and asphalt in the middle of the street, and beautifully, hideously elegant brownstone stoops to walk up, and yet a guy could walk about all day and all night on this expensive material and be looking for a crust of bread. That's what got me. The incongruousness of it. If one could only dash out with a dinner bell and yell, "Listen, listen, people, I'm a guy what's hungry. Who wants shoe shined? Who wants the garbage brought out? Who wants the drain pipes cleaned out?" If you could only go out in the street and put it to them clear like that. But no, you don't dare to open your trap. If you tell a guy in the street you're hungry, you scare the shit out of him. He runs like hell. That's something I never understood. I don't understand it yet. The whole thing is so simple. You just say yes when someone comes up to you. And if you can't say yes, you can take him by the arm and ask some other bird to help you out. Why you have to don a uniform and kill men you don't know just to get that crust of bread is a mystery to me. That's what I think about, more than about whose trap it's going down or how much it costs. Why should I give a fuck about what anything costs? I'm here to live, not to calculate. And that's just what the bastards don't want you to do, to live. They want you to spend your whole life adding up figures. That makes sense to them. That's reasonable. That's intelligent. If I were running the boat, things wouldn't be so orderly, perhaps. But it would be gayer, by Jesus. You wouldn't have to shit in your pants over trifles. Maybe there wouldn't be macadamized roads and streamlined cars and loudspeakers and gadgets of a million billion varieties. Maybe there wouldn't even be glass in the windows. Maybe you'd have to sleep on the ground. Maybe there wouldn't be French cooking and Italian cooking and Chinese cooking. Maybe people would kill each other when their patience was exhausted. And maybe nobody would stop them, because there wouldn't be any jails or any cops or judges. And there certainly wouldn't be any cabinet ministers or legislatures, because there wouldn't be any goddamn laws to obey or disobey. And maybe it would take months and years to trek from place to place. But you wouldn't need a visa or a passport or a carte d'identité, because you wouldn't be registered anywhere. And you wouldn't bear a number. If you wanted to change your name every week, you could do it, because it wouldn't make any difference, since you wouldn't own anything except what you could carry around with you. And why would you want to own anything when everything would be free?